Skill 2. Share vulnerability. 7. Tell me what you want and I'll help you. On July 10, 1989, United Airlines Flight 232 left Denver and headed for Chicago with 285 passengers on board. The weather was sunny and mild, with light winds out of the west at 13 miles per hour. For the first hour and 10 minutes of the trip, everything went perfectly. Over Iowa, the crew, consisting of Captain Al Haynes, First Officer Bill Records, and Flight Engineer Dudley Dvorak, put the plane on autopilot, ate lunch, and shot the breeze. Haynes, 57, was good at shooting the breeze. A low-key Texan and a former Marine, he had an amiable manner appreciated by his crews. 2 years from retirement, he was planning for the next stage of life, when he would pilot an RV around the country with his wife, Darlene. Then, at 3:16, came a loud explosion from the tail. The plane shook fiercely, then started climbing and tilting hard to the right. Records grabbed one of the two control wheels, known as yokes, and said, "I have the airplane." Checking the gauges, the crew realized the plane's tail engine, one of the DC-10's three engines, was gone. Meanwhile, the plane kept tilting farther to the right, despite Records' efforts to correct it. "Al?" Records said, trying to keep his voice calm. "I can't control the airplane." Haynes seized his yoke. "I got it," he said. But he didn't have it. He pulled with all his strength, but the controls barely budged. The plane kept tilting to the right, until it felt like it was nearly standing on the wing. Later investigators would trace the explosion to a microscopic crack in a 6-foot diameter fan inside the tail engine. The consequences of the explosion, however, went beyond the loss of the engine, which could normally be overcome. Shrapnel had sliced the main and backup hydraulic control lines through which the pilots operated the rudder, ailerons, and wing flaps. In short, the explosion removed the pilot's ability to control the plane. The term the National Transportation Safety Board uses for this type of event is catastrophic failure. Airlines didn't bother training pilots for catastrophic failure for two reasons. First, such failures are extremely rare. The odds of losing hydraulics and backups had been calculated at 1 in a billion. Second, they are invariably fatal. Haynes managed to stop the roll by using the throttles to increase power to the right-wing engine and decrease power to the left-wing engine. The asymmetric thrust helped the plane to slowly tilt back to a rough semblance of level flight. But it did nothing to fix the bigger problem. The controls wouldn't budge. The plane was now wobbling through the Iowa sky like a poorly made paper airplane, porpoising up and down thousands of feet each minute. Haynes and Records continued to wrestle with the yokes. The flight stewards moved through the cabin, trying to restore calm. One family took out a Bible and began to pray. In an aisle seat of first class, a 46-year-old man named Denny Fitch was cleaning up the coffee that had spilled on his lap when the explosion happened. Fitch worked for United as a pilot trainer. He spent his days in a flight simulator, teaching pilots how to handle emergencies. Now he spoke with a flight attendant and asked her to inform the captain of his willingness to help. The word came back, "Send him up." Fitch walked up the aisle, opened the cockpit door, and his heart dropped. "The scene to me as a pilot was unbelievable," Fitch later told a reporter. Both the pilots were in short-sleeved shirts, the tendons being raised on their forearms, their knuckles were white. The first thing that strikes your mind is, "Dear God, I'm going to die this afternoon." The only question that remains is, "How long is it going to take Iowa to hit me?" Fitch scanned the gauges, trying to make sense of them. He had never seen a complete hydraulic failure before, and like the pilots, he was having trouble comprehending what was going on. Flight engineer Dvorak was on the radio to United's maintenance seeking advice. It was a moment of peak confusion. "Tell me," Fitch said to Haynes. "Tell me what you want, and I'll help you." Haynes gestured to the engine throttles that were located on the console between the two pilots. As Haynes and Records had their hands full wrestling with the yokes, someone needed to run the throttles to try to maintain level flight. Fitch moved forward, knelt between the seats, and grasped the throttles with both hands. Shoulder to shoulder, the three men began to do something that no pilots had ever done, fly a DC-10 without any controls. They began to communicate in a particular way, through short, urgent bursts. Haynes:
Okay, let's start this sucker down a little more.
Fitch:
Okay, set your power a little bit.
Haynes:
Anybody have any ideas about what to do about the landing gear?
He, Dvorak, is talking to maintenance.
Fitch:
Dvorak is talking to maintenance. I'm gonna alternate gear you. Maybe that will even help you. If there is no fluid, I don't know how outboard ailerons are going to help you.
Haynes:
How do you, we, get gear down?
Fitch:
Well, they can free fall. The only thing is we alternate the gear. We got the landing gear doors down?
Haynes:
Yep.
Records:
We're gonna have trouble stopping, too.
Haynes:
Oh yeah, we don't have any brakes.
Records:
No brakes?
Haynes:
Well, we have some brakes, but not much.
Fitch:
Braking will be a one-shot deal. Just mash it. Mash it once. That's all you get. I'm gonna turn you. I'm gonna give you a left turn back to the airport. Is that okay?
Haynes:
I got it.
A few minutes later: Haynes:
A little left bank. Back. Back.
Fitch:
Hold this thing level if you can.
Haynes:
Level, baby. Level. Level.
Dvorak:
We're turning now.
Fitch:
More power. More power. Give him more power.
Records:
More power. Full power.
Fitch:
Power picks him up.
Unknown voice:
Right turn. Throttle back.
Haynes:
Can we turn left?
Dvorak, speaking to Fitch:
Do you want this seat?
Fitch:
Yes, do you mind?
Dvorak:
I don't mind. I think that you know what you're doing there.
The term pilots use to describe this type of short-burst communication is notifications. A notification is not an order or a command. It provides context, telling of something noticed, placing a spotlight on one discrete element of the world. Notifications are the humblest and most primitive form of communication, the equivalent of a child's finger point. I see this. Unlike commands, they carry unspoken questions. Do you agree? What else do you see? In a typical landing or takeoff, a proficient crew averages 20 notifications per minute. During their interactions after the explosion, the makeshift crew of Flight 232 communicated at a rate of more than 60 notifications per minute. Some of the interactions consisted of big, open-ended questions, mostly asked by Haynes.
How do we get the landing gear down? Anybody have any ideas?
These are not the kinds of questions one would normally expect a captain to ask. In fact, they're the opposite. Normally, a captain's job in an emergency is to be in command and to project capability and coolness. Yet over and over, Haynes notified his crew of a very different truth. Your captain has no idea what is going on or how to fix it. Can you help? This combination of notifications and open-ended questions added up to a pattern of interaction that was neither smooth nor graceful. It was clunky, unconfident, and full of repetitions. Conceptually, it resembled a person feeling his way through a dark room, sensing obstacles and navigating fitfully around them.
We're gonna have trouble stopping, too.
Oh yeah, we don't have any brakes.
No brakes?
Well, we have some brakes.
Just mash it. Mash it once.
Interacting in this stilted, unconfident fashion, the crew of Flight 232 solved a complex series of problems while flying at 400 miles per hour. They figured out how to optimally distribute power between the two engines and how to try to anticipate the porpoising movements the plane was making. They communicated with the cabin, attendants, passengers, flight control, maintenance, and emergency crews on the ground. They chose routes, calculated descent rates, prepared for evacuation, and even cracked jokes. As they got closer to Sioux City, the air traffic controller cleared them to land on any of the airport's runways. Haynes chuckled and asked, "You want to be particular and make it a runway, huh?" Everyone laughed. A few minutes later, flying at twice the normal landing speed and descending at 6 times the normal rate, Flight 232 attempted to land. A wingtip dipped and dug into the runway, sending the plane into a fiery cartwheel. The crash was terrible, but 185 people survived, including the entire crew. Some walked out of the wreckage into a cornfield. The survival of so many passengers was termed a miracle. In the weeks afterward, as part of its investigation, the National Transportation Safety Board placed experienced crews in simulators and recreated the conditions faced by Flight 232 at the moment it lost all hydraulics. The simulation was run 28 times. All 28 times, the planes crashed, spiraling to the ground without getting close to Sioux City. All of which underlines a strange truth. The crew of Flight 232 succeeded not because of their individual skills, but because they were able to combine those skills into a greater intelligence. They demonstrated that a series of small, humble exchanges... Anybody have any ideas? Tell me what you want, and I'll help you. Can unlock a group's ability to perform. The key, as we're about to learn, involves the willingness to perform a certain behavior that goes against our every instinct. Sharing vulnerability. So far, we've spent this book in what you might call the glue department, exploring how successful groups create belonging. Now we'll turn our attention to the muscle, to see how successful groups translate connection into trusting cooperation. When you watch highly cohesive groups in action, you will see many moments of fluid, trusting cooperation. These moments often happen when the group is confronted with a tough obstacle. For example, a SEAL team navigating a training course, or an improv comedy team navigating a sketch. Without communication or planning, the group starts to move and think as one, finding its way through the obstacle in the same way that a school of fish finds its way through a coral reef, as if they are all wired into the same brain. It's beautiful. If you look closely, however, you will also notice something else. Sprinkled amid the smoothness and fluency are moments that don't feel so beautiful. These moments are clunky, awkward, and full of hard questions. They contain pulses of profound tension as people deal with hard feedback and struggle together to figure out what is going on. What's more, these moments don't happen by accident. They happen by design. At Pixar, those uncomfortable moments happen in what they call brain trust meetings. The brain trust is Pixar's method of assessing and improving its movies during their development. Each film is brain trusted about half a dozen times at regular intervals. The meeting brings the film's director together with a handful of the studio's veteran directors and producers, all of whom watch the latest version of the movie and offer their candid opinion. From a distance, the brain trust appears to be a routine huddle. Up close, it's more like a painful medical procedure, specifically a dissection that spotlights, names, and analyzes the film's flaws in breathtaking detail. A brain trust meeting is not fun. It is where directors are told that their characters lack heart, their storylines are confusing, and their jokes fall flat. But it's also where those movies get better. "The brain trust is the most important thing we do by far," said Pixar president Ed Catmull. "It depends on completely candid feedback." In rhythm and tone, brain trust meetings resemble the atmosphere inside the cockpit of Flight 232. They consist of a steady stream of "here's the bad news" notifications, accompanied by a few big, scary questions. "Does anybody know how to land this thing?" Participants spend most of the time in a state of brow-furrowing struggle as they grapple with the fact that the movie, at the moment, isn't working. All our movies suck at first, Catmull says. The brain trust is where we figure out why they suck, and it's also where they start to not suck. At the Navy SEALs, such uncomfortable, candor-filled moments happen in the after-action review, or AAR. The AAR is a gathering that takes place immediately after each mission or training session. Team members put down their weapons, grab a snack and water, and start talking. As in brain trusts, the team members name and analyze problems and face uncomfortable questions head-on. Where did we fail? What did each of us do, and why did we do it? What will we do differently next time? AARs can be raw, painful, and filled with pulses of emotion and uncertainty. They're not real fun, said Christopher Baldwin, a former operator with SEAL Team 6. They can get tense at times. I've never seen people fist fight, but it can get close. Still, it's probably the most crucial thing we do together, aside from the missions themselves, because that's where we figure out what really happened and how to get better. While the SEALs and Pixar generate these moments in a structured way, other groups use looser, more organic methods. At Gramercy Tavern, a New York restaurant whose staff ranks as the culinary world's version of a SEAL team, I watched as Whitney McDonald was minutes away from a moment she had long anticipated, her first ever shift as a front waiter. The lunch crowd was lining up on the sidewalk, and she was excited and a bit nervous. Assistant General Manager Scott Reinhardt approached her. For a pep talk, I presumed. I was wrong. Okay, Reinhardt said, fixing Whitney with a bright, penetrating gaze. The one thing we know about today is that it's not going to go perfectly. I mean, it could, but odds are really, really, really high that it won't. A flicker of surprise traveled across Whitney's face. She had trained for 6 months for this day, learning every painstaking detail of the job, hoping to perform well. She had worked as a back server, taken notes, sat in on lineup meetings, and shadowed shift after shift. Now she was being told in no uncertain terms that she was destined to screw up. So here's how we'll know if you had a good day, Reinhardt continued. If you ask for help 10 times, then we'll know it was good. If you try to do it all alone, his voice trailed off, the implication clear. It will be a catastrophe. On the face of it, these awkward moments at Pixar, the SEALs, and Gramercy Tavern don't make sense. These groups seem to intentionally create awkward, painful interactions that look like the opposite of smooth cooperation. The fascinating thing is, however, these awkward, painful interactions generate the highly cohesive, trusting behavior necessary for smooth cooperation. Let's look deeper into how this happens.